On the 3rd of November of 2025, an anonymous user posted this satellite image on X with the caption, "This is the most disturbing Google Earth image ever." The user purported that the image depicted a huge dark stain of blood littered with the bodies of hundreds of victims of a recent massacre committed in Sudan. A shocking sight that quickly went viral across the internet, with the anonymous user demanding the viewer speak out on the ongoing genocide that's taking place in the country. The image was viewed more than 15 million times on X and is probably the single most viewed piece of media that has come out from Sudan in the past 2 years during the country's devastating civil war. You've maybe even seen this image yourself, and it's all a terrible tragedy because this image isn't what you think it is. The image was posted to X at the same time that an unprecedented massacre of people was taking place in the heavily populated city of El Fasher in the territory of Darfur in western Sudan. But the image shows an area in a much smaller town called Kumia that's about 300 kilometers away from El Fasher. Information provided by Google Earth also showed that this particular satellite image was captured on the 16th of March of 2024, more than a year and a half ago before recent events. And even more damning, earlier satellite images captured over the same location from 2022 before the civil war in Sudan had even begun still show the exact same stain in the exact same place. Because in reality, this is simply a watering hole, and the image posted to X only shows a herd of cattle gathered around it drinking. Not a pile of human bodies and blood left over from a massacre. And what's truly infuriating about this whole episode is that even though this particular mega viral post that was made to X was false and misleading, it remains highly probable that the greatest crime of the entire 21st century did indeed just take place 300 kilometers further to the north in the city of El Fasher. And so far, almost the entire world hasn't even heard about it at best, or is actively ignoring and suppressing it at worst. The city of El Fasher is the capital of Sudan's North Darfur state, and when the current civil war in the country began in April of 2023, it was then under the control of the Sudanese armed forces. Their rivals in the civil war, the Rapid Support Forces, or the RSF, almost immediately began laying siege to the city the moment the war began, trapping nearly all of its estimated 260,000 residents inside, half of whom were believed to be children. For the next 18 apocalyptic, brutal months, the RSF continued tightening their noose around the city, bombarding it with artillery and drones, refusing to allow the passage of any aid or food in, and any people in or out, and steadily letting the population inside weaken to famine and disease. More than 220 separate RSF assaults were launched to seize control over the city throughout the whole 18-month siege, a siege that UNICEF at one point referred to as a siege out of the medieval era, rather than one from our own. In August of 2025, the RSF began constructing a massive berm, a raised sand barrier, completely encircling the perimeter of El Fasher to tighten their grip over the city even further, controlling the flow of people and materiel in and out even more ruthlessly. By early October of 2025, El Fasher and its 260,000 residents stuck inside were completely surrounded by this berm, all contained into a small area of just 7 square miles that they could no longer escape from and where they were blocked off from the rest of the outside world, as seen in the satellite imagery. And throughout the entire period of this horrible siege, numerous people and experts from all around the world were consistently sounding the alarm that if and when El Fasher fell to the RSF, an unbelievable massacre was awaiting for the beleaguered population still trapped inside, because the RSF's nature has been well known for a while now. In mid-2023, soon after the civil war in Sudan began, the RSF captured the capital of the West Darfur state, a city known as El Geneida. There, they systematically murdered as many as 15,000 of the city's residents. Nearly 2 years later, in April of 2025, on their way to El Fasher, the RSF overran what was then Sudan's largest refugee camp and committed a similar atrocity, murdering more than 1,500 more people and forcibly displacing another 400,000 others. Throughout the entire siege of El Fasher, the RSF's rhetoric repeatedly portrayed the city's entire population, half of whom were children, as valid military targets who needed to be annihilated, threats that the outside international community ignored and ultimately failed to act upon. Finally, by the 26th of October, after 18 months of siege and nearly constant warnings, the final positions of the Sudanese armed forces were overwhelmed in the city, and the RSF flooded in from beyond the berm to assume control. And they immediately began carrying out what might well be the most brutal and horrific war crime of the entire 21st century. Enormous, ethnically targeted, and systematic door-to-door mass executions began taking place that have been so catastrophic in scale that it is true. Pools of blood have been visible in satellite images that have been captured over El Fasher, even though that one specific one that was posted to X happened to be false. There have been plenty of other satellite images taken that indeed appear to confirm this. There are satellite images like this one taken on the 31st of October, showing a pile of burned out vehicles adjacent to the berm that encircle the city. Perhaps most hauntingly are these series of satellite images that I'm about to show you. The first was captured over a former children's hospital in El Fasher on the 26th of October, the day that the city fell to the RSF's forces. Just 4 days later, the hospital's entire courtyard was filled with white shapes measuring between 1.5 and 2 meters in length, while a fresh disturbance in the soil nearby was measured between 5 and 6 meters in length. 3 days later, the shapes in the courtyard remained while the excavation outside had widened to 12 by 8 meters. And the following day, a layer of fresh soil covered up the excavation area, suggesting just one terrible crime here across an entire city full of terrible crimes that were and still are taking place. Documented by video after video after video that's been released by the RSF that due to their graphic nature, I won't be sharing here. The sheer scale of the killing that took place in El Fasher after the RSF took it over is at present unknown. The city was subjected to a communications blackout shortly after the RSF overran it, which as of this video's production, continues to remain in effect. But analysts who have been studying the civil war in Sudan and following the siege in El Fasher, who have looked at the evidence available, suggest that the scale of death taking place is unlike anything else we've seen in the 21st century. Nathaniel Raymond, the executive director at Yale's humanitarian research lab that has been extensively following the war in Sudan, said that more people could have died in just 1 week in El Fasher after the RSF takeover than have died during the past 2 years of war in Gaza, which is just horrendously apocalyptic to even imagine. At least 69,000 people have been killed in Gaza, according to Gaza's health ministry, during the war with Israel over these past 2 years, implying that the Yale Humanitarian Research Lab believes that even more human beings than that could have been killed in just a single week in El Fasher. And there's a very good chance that this is the very first time that you're even hearing about it. To put the scale of this calamity even further into context, if accurate, that's a scale of killing that hasn't been seen anywhere in the world since the opening days of the Rwandan genocide in 1994. And yet, the world outside of El Fasher, Darfur, and Sudan has barely even heard anything about it. Even as the RSF continues its killings in El Fasher and continues its advances across the rest of the country that may yet befall similar horrendous ends, the world is doing precious little to stop the horrors that are actively taking place in Darfur right now, with other major conflicts competing for international attention that are still taking place in Ukraine and Gaza. But if you'd like to learn about what's happening in Darfur right now, if you give a damn about what's happening here, and if you want to learn the ongoing genocide sources and how it might be stopped, I'm begging you to watch this video and to share it more than any other video that I've ever produced on this channel. Because there is a way to stop what's happening in Darfur before tens to hundreds of thousands of more people are lost there forever. And to get to how, you need to first understand what's happening in Darfur in the first place and how this all got so terrible there today. Darfur's history is complicated to say the least. Today, it's a region of Western Sudan that borders the Central African Republic, Chad, and Libya. But that's a fairly recent development historically. Existing at the fringes of both the Arab and the Sub-Saharan African worlds, Darfur has experienced centuries of migration, ethnic mixing, and intermarriage that has made ethnic identity here extremely fluid and difficult for outsiders to parse. Many modern commentators have simplified the modern Darfur conflict by boiling it all down into one of ancient ethnic tensions between Arabs and Black Africans. But that's not entirely accurate. If you as an outsider travel to Darfur, you won't notice any visible racial or religious differences between the two sides that are involved in this violence. Everybody present in Darfur, regardless of whether or not they identify as Arab or African, are equally Black, equally Muslim, and equally indigenous to the land that they reside on. Within Darfur, the identities of Arab and African are more based on linguistics and occupation. There are a variety of Arabic-speaking nomadic tribes who practice pastoralism that identify as Arab, largely concentrated in northern Darfur historically, and a variety of non-Arabic-speaking sedentary groups who practice farming, largely concentrated in the south, who identify as more African, with the more well-known larger groups being the Masalit, the Zaghawa, and the Fur, the latter of whom are the group that the region of Darfur itself is named after, roughly translating into Land of the Fur. Even still, it's important for you to understand that these identities are not rigid in Darfur, and that the occupational identities between pastoralist Arabs and farmer Africans are often crossed. For most of the pre-colonial era, the Fur were the dominant group in this part of the world, and they maintained an independent sultanate for centuries until it was crushed and conquered fairly recently historically in 1874 by a Sudanese warlord who joined it for the first time into Sudan. Sudan itself was then later conquered by the colonial forces of Britain and Egypt, and Sudan was transformed into a joint Anglo-Egyptian colony in 1899. At the same time, the Darfur Sultanate was restored by a descendant of the royal lineage of the previous sultanate, and so Darfur was allowed to retain its independence again in exchange for an annual tribute. Darfur then remained independent again for a number of years until the First World War, when its leader began aligning himself with the Ottoman Empire, which provoked the British into invading and conquering Darfur and annexing it back into Anglo-Egyptian Sudan in 1916. Meaning that Darfur has really only been a part of Sudan for just a little over 100 years now. Throughout the entire period of colonial and post-colonial Sudanese rule in Darfur that has persisted since 1916, Darfur has remained a deeply rural, remote, underdeveloped, and neglected region out of the country's periphery. Sudan itself came to be dominated politically, culturally, and economically by a relatively small group of Arabic-speaking elites in the Upper Nile Valley near the capital and the largest city of Khartoum, to whom all resources in the country were sent to and were virtually all development being concentrated without much at all shared with any of the peripheral regions that were largely made up of non-Arabs and or non-Muslims, who understandably came to feel increasingly marginalized, particularly in Darfur in the west and especially in what would eventually become South Sudan in the south. Darfur is a geographically huge region that's roughly comparable in size to Spain, and since it is a long region from north to south, it also extends across a variety of different climate zones. The northernmost parts of Darfur are arid deserts within the Sahara that connect with the borders of Egypt and Libya. The center is a rugged, arid plateau that is dominated by the towering Mara Mountains that provide abundant water, while the south is a rich savanna environment that also receives a considerable amount of rainfall. Broadly speaking, the northern parts of Darfur have historically been inhabited by camel-owning Arabic-speaking nomadic peoples who seek out grazing land for their livestock, while the southern parts have historically been inhabited by farming, non-Arabic-speaking sedentary people. For centuries, as the northern Arabic-speaking nomads traveled south with their herds, they entered into negotiations for their animal routes with the farming communities that they came into contact with, which came to be legally sanctioned by the Sudanese government itself during the post-colonial era. But in the 1980s, this historical system began rapidly breaking down in the face of a catastrophic drought and ensuing famine. As the climate began to change in Darfur, the available supply of arable land began to shrink. Rainfall began becoming less frequent and more difficult to predict at the same time as Darfur's population was rising rapidly, which kickstarted a dangerous cycle in which arable land along the southern rim of the Sahara came to be used more intensively to support the growing population, which in turn furthered the rate of desertification, and so on. In 1983 and 84, the rains in Darfur failed completely. Desperate farmers in the south, faced with the failure of their crops, began switching to animal husbandry and grazing, while desperate nomads in the north, faced with a shrinking supply of grazing land, began moving south and entering into conflicts with the southerners. Tens of thousands of Darfuris simply walked across the country to Khartoum in search of food, only to become falsely declared as refugees from Chad and sent back by the government to Darfur where they had come from, where there wasn't any food. In the end, a devastating famine killed an estimated 95,000 people in Darfur between these years, out of a population that at the time stood at just 3.1 million, implying that about 3% of the population was lost. And at the same time, the increasing competition over shrinking resources like arable land and water was being inflamed by a new sense of ethnic identity that was being pushed in by Sudan's elites and by outside influences. Sudan's Arabic-speaking elites, far away in Khartoum, had long concentrated the lion's share of economic development within their own region at the expense of all of the country's peripheries. But they also attempted to create a unifying national identity in the post-colonial era that was based around Arabism and Islam, much to the fury of the non-Arab and non-Muslim peoples around the periphery. These policies especially inflamed tensions in the south of Sudan, where the people were neither Arab nor Muslim, and led to decades of massive civil wars and violence between the north and the south that ultimately resulted in the deaths of millions of people. But they also led to steadily rising tensions in Darfur as well, as violence from the north-south conflict spilled over into it. The international borders between Darfur and neighboring countries like Chad and Libya are particularly porous and in many cases only really exist on paper. Many of the non-Arabic speaking ethnic groups in Darfur, like the Zaghawa and the Masalit, straddle the border with Chad and spill over onto the other side, just like the Arabic speaking groups in northern Darfur do as well. Meaning that conflicts erupting in either Chad or Darfur have a bad habit of spreading across the international border across their communities. This problem was particularly acute in the 1980s, at the same time as Darfur was suffering its chronic famine, when Chad was simultaneously involved in a series of civil wars that saw heavy military intervention from Muammar Gaddafi's Libya. At this time, Gaddafi, an ardent pan-Arab nationalist, was obsessed with creating a geopolitical vision that he called the Arab Belt across the Sahel region of Africa, a series of statelets consisting of the Arabic-speaking peoples found across Chad, Niger, and Mali that he wanted to separate from their countries in order to create a continuous belt of Arab-majority states across the Sahel from the Red Sea to the Atlantic. To support this goal, Gaddafi created a paramilitary militia that he called the Islamic Legion in the early 1970s. It came to be largely composed of thousands of impoverished Arabic-speaking volunteers in search of money from Chad and especially from the nomadic northern communities in Darfur. And it was deployed by Gaddafi to fight against the Chadian government throughout the 1980s along with a flood of weapons. The Islamic Legion took advantage of the porous borders between Chad and Darfur, and utilized Darfur as a rear base to launch raids and attacks into Chad from, while their weapons proliferated across Darfur as well. The Islamic Legion came to openly embrace an ethnic Arab supremacist ideology that was pushed down from the top by Gaddafi himself. And after Libya was ultimately defeated in Chad and the Legion was disbanded in the late 1980s, many of their well-trained members began returning back home to Darfur, armed with both their weapons and their ideology amidst the increasing environmental issues that were already pushing the region towards conflict. These returning former members of the Islamic Legion then founded a new political bloc in Darfur that they called the Arab Gathering, which continued to espouse an Arab supremacist ideology and claimed that the Arabic-speaking people in Darfur were being politically and economically marginalized by the non-Arabic-speaking African peoples in the region, like the Fur and the Zaghawa, despite the fact that the Arabic-speaking peoples made up a majority of the overall population. Non-Arabic-speaking African-identifying communities then began forming self-defense militias in order to resist them. And so, identity divisions that had once been local and ecological in Darfur, like herders versus farmers, suddenly became ethno-political and even racialized in nature in a way that they had never really been before the 1980s. While the central government in Khartoum that also espoused an Arab and Muslim supremacist ideology began arming and supporting the Arab Gathering and other Arab militias in Darfur to help retain their control over the region. Small-scale violence between both communities began building, resulting in a few thousand deaths across the 1990s that was only overshadowed by the much larger fighting that was still raging between the north and the south. By 2003, after more than 21 years of civil war between the north and the south and after as many as 2 million deaths, both sides were exhausted in a stalemate, and so the Sudanese government, dominated by the Arabic-speaking elites of Khartoum, decided to finally enter into peace negotiations with the south to put an end to the war once and for all. The agreement they came up with ended the long-running North-South Civil War and paved the way for the South's ultimate secession and independence that would come a few years later in 2011. but it was also heavily criticized at the time for only focusing on the North-South conflict and none of Sudan's other peripheral conflicts like the one that had emerged separately in Darfur. Enraged at the neglect that was afforded to Darfur and its problems by the elites in Khartoum once again, two rebel movements emerged in the region called the Sudan Liberation Army, or SLA, and the Justice and Equality Movement, or JEM, both of which demanded greater autonomy for Darfur from the central government and a redistribution of political power and economic resources. By April of 2003, rebels from both of these groups began attacking Sudanese army bases across Darfur and began scoring rapid victories due to the Sudanese army still being overextended and preoccupied down in the south. So, instead of diverting their army away from the south to take care of the situation, the Sudanese government resorted to exploiting the ethnic tensions that had recently emerged in Darfur and began arming the Arabic-speaking groups in the region to turn against the others and act as their legal enforcers instead of the army. These Arabic-speaking militias in Darfur, armed by the government and backed by the regular army brigades and the air force, came to be known as the Janjaweed, and they were sanctioned by the government to put down the rebellion in Darfur by any and all means necessary. Any village in the region that was inhabited by the same ethnicity as a rebel leader, who were most often non-Arabs, were considered to be valid targets for their attacks. And because the government usually couldn't pay the fighters of the Janjaweed a reliable salary like they could the army, they enabled them to loot and pillage at will wherever they advanced for their compensation instead. The result was a devastatingly brutal crackdown in Darfur that for a time put previously obscure Darfur front and center on the world stage and the international agenda. Tens of thousands of civilians in Darfur were directly massacred by the Janjaweed and their collaborators, while hundreds of thousands of others are believed to have died due to the resulting famine and disease that their actions caused. In total, between 2003 and 2005, around 300,000 people in Darfur were likely killed as a direct result of the Janjaweed's actions. Satellite images taking over Darfur at the time showed villages ablaze and clear signs of mass atrocities. A major advocacy group was formed in the United States called the Save Darfur Coalition to raise the public's awareness of what was going on and to put pressure on the US government to take decisive action to stop it. And it was backed by multiple influential celebrities at the time, like George Clooney, Don Cheadle, Mia Farrow, Angelina Jolie, Brad Pitt, Alicia Keys, Oprah Winfrey, Matt Damon, and Johnny Depp, among many others. The publicity and pressure that they applied on the U.S. government contributed to then-U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell to formally declare that the Janjaweed was committing genocide in Darfur in 2004. Around the same time, an inquiry by the UN concluded that there was irrefutable evidence of war crimes taking place in Darfur on a vast scale, and urged the Security Council to refer the case to the International Criminal Court, or the ICC. A subsequent UN resolution demanded that the Sudanese government disarm the Janjaweed and halt their military flights that they were conducting over Darfur, though the UN has consistently avoided using the term genocide while referring to these events that took place in Darfur. A great degree of controversy arose over whether or not the events that took place in Darfur at this time constituted the crime of genocide or not. To date, the US government is the only government in the world that has actually declared the crisis in Darfur during that time to have been genocidal in nature. The UN formally concluded that while the Sudanese government's actions in Darfur were brutal and deliberate, they lacked genocidal intent because the government's primary goal was counterinsurgency, not the deliberate destruction of entire groups of people. While others, like the US government, disagreed and concluded that the Janjaweed was specifically targeting non-Arab groups in Darfur with violence, all of which gave rise to a unique term to describe the events that took place in Darfur at this time, the ambiguous genocide. By 2006, the government and some of the rebel groups in Darfur signed a peace agreement. But other rebel factions continued to fight on, and the overall violence continued, but to a lesser scale than between 2003 and 2005. The Janjaweed continued to terrorize the population in Darfur, while the government blamed the continued violence on the rebels who had rejected the peace accords and claimed, rather implausibly, that only 10,000 people in Darfur had been killed by all of the violence that was taking place. The government initially refused to allow international monitors into Darfur and heavily restricted the flow of information that was coming out of the region, while they vehemently opposed the UN's efforts to deploy a peacekeeping force to Darfur based on the argument that such a force would be a violation of their national sovereignty. Eventually, in 2007, Sudan relented and allowed a joint African Union-UN peacekeeping force to be deployed to Darfur to protect civilians and monitor ceasefires that, at the time, was the largest peacekeeping force assembled anywhere in the world. By the 2010s, the rebel movements in Darfur began splintering into smaller factions, and although the scale of violence declined, more than 2.5 million people in the region continued to remain displaced in refugee camps, out of a total population that at the time stood at only just a little over 6 million. The government would eventually declare the war in Sudan to be over by 2016, and in 2017, the UN began scaling down their operations as the pace of violence continued declining. By 2020, the UN's mission would conclude entirely. But despite the overwhelming evidence towards the scale of war crimes and atrocities that took place in Darfur during all of this time, hardly anyone has ever been legally held to account, which has no doubt instilled a sense of complete impunity amongst those committing the current atrocities in Darfur again today. Although the Sudanese government sometimes paid lip service to holding Janjaweed officers and commanders responsible for war crimes, no such officers or commanders have yet ever been brought to trial. Far to the contrary, in 2013, the ragtag Janjaweed militia from Darfur was formally elevated in status by Sudan's then-dictator, Omar al-Bashir, into a completely separate and parallel armed forces in the country that came to be called the Rapid Support Forces, or the RSF. Done so because al-Bashir hoped that the move would earn him their loyalty and enable him to play the RSF and the Sudanese armed forces against each other to prevent them from ever being able to join together and overthrow him. The ICC has done a little bit better than the Sudanese government, but not by much. The ICC issued warrants for Omar al-Bashir's arrest in 2009 and 2010 on charges of crimes against humanity and genocide. But to date, the court has still never managed to get their hands on him. Very recently, in October of 2025, the ICC found one former Janjaweed commander, best known by his alias Kushaib, guilty on 27 counts of war crimes and crimes against humanity that were committed in Darfur. But to date, he is the only person who has ever been brought to trial over what happened in Darfur more than 20 years ago. And the only reason it happened at all was because he voluntarily surrendered himself to the ICC in 2020 out of a fear that an even worse fate was awaiting him if he remained any longer in Sudan. Eventually, Omar al-Bashir's strategy of playing the RSF and the Sudanese armed forces against each other failed by 2019, and he was overthrown during a popular revolution that turned into a coup. The RSF's leader, Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, better known as Hemedti, and the Sudanese Armed Forces leader, Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, then entered into a power-sharing agreement with al-Burhan serving as president and Hemedti serving as vice president. 4 years later, after almost constant failed power-sharing renegotiations, the two men couldn't stand to share power in Sudan with the other any longer, and by April of 2023, their rival armies finally began shooting at each other, and so began the current ongoing civil war in the country. Now, with all of this context that I've been building for you, it's very important to understand right now that the current civil war in Sudan isn't just a war between two power-hungry rival generals. It's also one between two fundamentally different heirs of the same regime that has dominated Sudan ever since it gained its independence from Britain in the 1950s. The Sudanese Armed Forces, led by the same kind of Arab officers from Sudan's longtime ethnic and political center in the Upper Nile Valley, and the RSF, which is just the latest iteration of Darfur's Arabic-speaking ideological militias that draws a continuous line back to the Janjaweed of the 2000s and Gaddafi's Islamic Legion of the 1980s and 70s. And even before the current enormous atrocity that appears to have just taken place in El Fasher happened, the war between them across Sudan was probably already the worst ongoing humanitarian crisis anywhere in the world, going even beyond the parallel tragedies that are also taking place in Ukraine and Gaza. The UN declared that famine had become endemic in Sudan more than a year ago, back in 2024, while further UN reports concluded that some 25 million people in the country are currently facing extreme levels of hunger, while at least 12 million people have been forced to flee from their homes, including 4 million who have fled the country altogether. By August of 2025, a little more than 2 years into the fighting of the war, the former U.S. Special Envoy for Sudan until very recently, Tom Perriello, reported that he believed the death toll from the war had exceeded more than 400,000 people. And this was while El Fasher was still under siege by the RSF and the massacre there had not yet even happened. And while the RSF and the Sudanese armed forces have been viciously fighting each other for power across the country with abundant war crimes, the RSF has also been furthering the ethnic-based terror in Darfur against the non-Arabic-speaking communities there that their Janjaweed predecessors began in the early 2000s. Many large-scale RSF perpetrated massacres of non-Arabic-speaking peoples in Darfur, like the Masalit, were well-documented even before their siege of El Fasher, such as at El Janina in 2023, where they systematically killed as many as 15,000 people, including the local governor, in house-to-house massacres, and drove hundreds of thousands of others out after taking the city over. Throughout the entire 18 months that El-Fasher was under a complete siege by the RSF, with more than 200,000 mostly non-Arabic-speaking Zaghawa civilians trapped inside, the international community did little to actually stop what nearly anyone who paid attention to this conflict knew would result in a catastrophic massacre if the RSF managed to break through. Throughout it all, the UN Security Council issued just two resolutions that only called for a temporary ceasefire and an end to the siege at El Fasher without any concrete enforcement mechanisms to back them up. In early 2025, with the siege still ongoing, one of the Biden administration's final acts was to declare that the RSF was once again responsible for committing genocide in Darfur, just like their Janjaweed predecessors, a determination that has been continued by the current Trump administration as well. Financial and travel sanctions have since been applied by the U.S. government on Hemedti and other RSF leadership, but none of these have caused any perceptible changes down on the ground. El-Fasher was still ultimately overrun by the RSF, and now, potentially tens of thousands of people who were trapped inside, terrified for more than 18 months, are dead. The evidence of which has flooded the internet from videos taken by the RSF themselves and from satellites orbiting above in space. And now that El-Fasher has fallen, the RSF has been left almost entirely in control of the whole of Darfur, meaning that there is a very real prospect that Sudan may further balkanize now between a genocidal RSF regime in power in Darfur and the Sudanese armed forces in power in the rest of the country that still remains, leaving behind the rest of Darfur's non-Arabic-speaking minorities to the RSF's mercy, which, based on all prior evidence, simply does not exist. More massacres and brutality in Darfur is all but a certainty with the RSF still in power. But if there's any silver lining from the scale of what's just happened in El-Fasher, it's the fact that for the first time since this horrible civil war began in Sudan, the world's attention has briefly returned back to Darfur again, and there is a small window of opportunity to pressure a change before the situation inevitably gets even more apocalyptic. The primary force that is enabling the RSF to commit their atrocities in Darfur is a key U.S. regional ally, the United Arab Emirates, or the UAE, who provided the RSF with the lion's share of their arms, finances, and political cover throughout this civil war. The UAE is one of the wealthiest countries in the world thanks to their enormous oil resources, and they're also one of the world's top international arms customers as well. Between 2007 and 2014, the UAE ordered more than $22 billion worth of conventional arms, mostly from the US and major Western European states like France and the UK. In 2020, the UAE entered into a massive brand new $23 billion arms deal with the United States, including modern F-35 fighters, Reaper drones, and billions of dollars worth of munitions. While they've doled out billions of dollars for additional arms purchases from France, Britain, Russia, and China as well. And huge amounts of these arms that the UAE have been purchasing from all around the world have been ending up in the hands of the RSF in Darfur. After the city of Omdurman near the capital was taken back over by the Sudanese armed forces earlier this year, they reported that they uncovered an arsenal of hundreds of modern American-made Javelin missile systems and countless rounds of 155mm artillery shells that the RSF had abandoned. Verified footage of RSF fighters have shown them armed with American-made M4 and AR-15 rifles. British-made engines have been discovered in RSF armored personnel carriers, along with French and Russian weapons and Chinese drones. The advanced Chinese-made CH-95 drone has been frequently spotted in the hands of the RSF in Darfur recently, which have given the RSF advanced military capabilities like long-range reconnaissance and airstrikes. but none of these countries have been directly supplying the RSF with these weapons, because they're being funneled into their hands by the UAE. A little over 2 years ago, the Wall Street Journal was the first major outlet that reported on the UAE supply chain of weapons to the RSF. At the time, the journal alleged that the UAE was flying cargo planes to a nearby airport across the border in Chad that were laden with weapons bound for the RSF, and that the UAE was disguising these cargo planes and arms shipments as humanitarian missions. In the spring of 2025, the RSF began experiencing a series of major military setbacks in their war against the Sudanese armed forces that culminated with their loss of the country's capital, Khartoum, in March. After that, fearing that the RSF was losing the war, evidence suggests that the UAE began rapidly increasing the pace of their arms deliveries to them, which has been reported by America's Defense Intelligence Agency and the State Department's Intelligence Bureau using battlefield and satellite images. In addition to their usual route of funneling arms into the RSF's hands through Chad, the UAE has begun adding additional arms smuggling routes using cargo planes to Somalia and Libya as well, with land transfers directly to the RSF continuing on from them. It was this rapid increase in arms from the UAE in mid-2025 that enabled the RSF to tighten their noose around El-Fasher and to increase the pace of their attacks and pressure, and which ultimately led to the probable massacre that we're currently observing from space. And without the major arms sales that countries are making with the UAE that are then being transferred by them to the RSF, it's doubtful that the RSF would be capable of continuing on fighting or committing its countless atrocities. The UAE is doing all of this because they see the RSF as the best odds at defending their own interests in Sudan. The UAE is ultimately interested in access to Sudan's strategic Red Sea ports, its agricultural commodities, and, most of all, the country's rich gold deposits. Sudan is one of the most naturally gold-rich countries in the world, and the richest areas are located in Darfur. And while smuggling gold out of the country isn't anything new, it has rapidly expanded since the start of the current civil war. For the past few years, an informal and clandestine arrangement has been established between the UAE and the RSF that sees weapons flowing towards the RSF and gold flowing back towards the UAE. Gold from RSF-run mines in Darfur is smuggled across borders into Chad, the Central African Republic, South Sudan, and Uganda, and then airlifted directly out to Dubai. In 2024, with the civil war raging throughout the year, the UAE was Sudan's largest export market with $1.6 billion worth of total exports, 91% of which was all just entirely gold, which also made up more than half of all of Sudan's exports. Gold has become one of the UAE's most significant diversification strategies away from oil, which has seen Dubai become transformed into one of the primary trading hubs in the global gold trade. The city is now home to thousands of gold traders and numerous gold refineries, while Africa has become the country's primary source of gold. Gold imports from Africa into the UAE nearly tripled over just a decade between 2012 and 2022. In 2022 specifically, the UAE imported roughly $59.5 billion worth of gold into the country, and 58% of that amount all just came from Africa, according to data acquired from SwissAid that was released in 2024. Very notably, this also meant that in 2022, almost 7% of the UAE's entire GDP was made up of imported African gold, and a significant amount of that has been coming from the mines of Darfur under the RSF's control. But the weapons that the UAE is providing to the RSF in exchange for this gold supply is directly contributing to enormous historical atrocities like what's just happened at El-Fasher. And the weapons that the US and other countries are selling to the UAE are directly contributing to it as well. The key to halting the RSF's wanton massacres and brutality in Darfur lies in pressuring the UAE into ending their support for the group. But that's unfortunately easier said than done. The UAE is a major US ally in the Middle East and is friendly and useful to Washington in many different ways. In addition to simply purchasing tens of billions of dollars worth of US weapons and stuffing the coffers of US defense industry companies, the UAE has also committed to investing a massive $1.4 trillion into the United States over the next 10 years in sectors like AI, data centers, energy, and manufacturing. The UAE hosts a major U.S. Air Force base in Al Dhafra, which is home to the U.S. 380th Air Expeditionary Wing that has been used to support aerial missions in the region against ISIS and Iran. The UAE has also been the most significant Arab power to date to join the Trump administration's Abraham Accords that normalize their relations with Israel, and they have voiced their support for Trump's proposed peace plan in Gaza as well. Piling on pressure on the UAE to cut their support for the RSF risks severing the lucrative gold trade that's flowing from Darfur to the UAE. And by extension, it risks jeopardizing the massive financial investments and arms purchases that the UAE is making with the United States, the status of a key U.S. Air Force base in the Middle East, and perhaps worst of all, it could jeopardize the whole Abraham Accords by causing the UAE to reconsider their recognition of Israel, which would risk upending what has so far been one of the Trump administration's greatest diplomatic victories. Nonetheless, the ongoing genocide that appears to be taking place in Darfur will not be stopped by the same kind of words, condemnations, and empty statements that the outside world has attempted so far. The only way that it stops is by actually interfering with the RSF's ability to kill. And the only way to do that is by severing the supply chain of weapons flowing towards them by the UAE. A combination of diplomatic pressure, sanctions, asset freezes, and suspending arms deals with the UAE is the only possible way to do this. But because there's simply so much money and influence that the UAE wields within the US, it's unclear if the US government will ever be able to actually muster the resolve to do what's necessary. I can only hope that I'm wrong and that in the future, even worse tragedies in Darfur following the nightmare that's already taking place in El Fasher can still be prevented before it's all far too late for everyone else who's still there. The horrors that are currently taking place in Darfur today also didn't just suddenly come out of nowhere. Just like how the Holocaust didn't begin in the 1940s and the Rwandan violence didn't begin in 1994, interethnic violence and genocides never begin in a vacuum and always happen after years or even decades of building tension and warning signs. And in Darfur's case, a lot of the origin for the violence taking place today goes back to Muammar Gaddafi and his influence over the region back in the 1970s and 80s. And if there were ever an award to be given for the most eccentric or bizarre leader of modern history, there's no other person who would deserve it better than Gaddafi. Always dripped out in his flamboyant robes and designer sunglasses for public appearances, Gaddafi's time in power in Libya that lasted for more than 40 years was full of some of international relations' most memorable moments. Like the time at the 35th G8 summit in 2008 when he proposed the partition of Switzerland after Swiss authorities had arrested his son for beating his servants at a hotel. Or the time when he came to a UN conference in New York City and attempted to pitch a massive tent that he intended to reside in inside of Central Park. Or the time he went on a possibly drug-fueled hour-long rant at the UN in 2009 about attempting to find JFK's real assassin and calling for the UN headquarters to be relocated to Libya. He also launched an invasion of neighboring Chad to the south of Libya in an attempt to conquer territory, and in the process, fanned the flames of ethnic tension and violence in Darfur in order to achieve his own ends. Among his many other conflicts that he started with the United States, his global support for countless terrorist and militant organizations that were as ideologically diverse as the IRA and the Japanese Red Army, and his own ultimate war with his own people in 2011, that led to a NATO military intervention and his own grisly, videotaped demise. He was, throughout it all, however, potentially the single most interesting and bizarre leader to have ever graced the world of geopolitics over the past half century. And because any real in-depth video about Gaddafi's time in power would immediately become demonetized and age-restricted here on YouTube, I made an entire new documentary exploring him in my brand new original documentary series that I'm calling Mad Kings instead, which take deeper dives into the bizarre personal lives and erratic decision-making of modern history's most unstable and eccentric dictators. And because of the inherently violent and darker subject material surrounding this series, my documentary deeply investigating the life and power of Gaddafi would never work out on YouTube, because it would instantly become demonetized and age-restricted, which means that YouTube's algorithm, which is based around showing you ads, would never be incentivized to actually show the video to you or to promote it. I deal with very large numbers of my videos on YouTube getting demonetized and age-restricted as they already are, probably even including the one that you just watched. And that's why I'll be uploading all of my documentaries and Mad Kings, including this one on Muammar Gaddafi, exclusively to Nebula. And why signing up to Nebula is the absolute best thing that you can do to support me and my channel. You'll also get access to way more content than just this new Mad King series as well. You'll also be able to watch the nearly 50 other exclusive documentaries that I've published to Nebula in my separate Modern Conflict series as well, which explore 21st century wars, battles, conflicts, and genocides using a level of depth of frankness that would also never work on YouTube without triggering demonetization or age restriction issues. This is all possible because the best part about Nebula is that it's jointly co-owned by myself and hundreds of other independent creators to make the projects that we're all actually deeply excited about without any fear of being censored or demonetized like we are on YouTube. Because, since it's a subscriber-based platform, we don't have to cater around the sensitive needs of advertisers and a faceless algorithm that nobody really understands. That's why there's tons of other new unique content on Nebula that's coming out all the time too that you'll also love. Like Neo's Underexposure series, Wendover Productions' The Logistics of X series, TLDR News' What to Follow USA series, and so, so many others. I also know that there's a lot of streaming platforms out there right now and you don't want to get stuck with another monthly cost to keep track of. But I also know that if you've watched this all the way through to the end, there is so much content on Nebula that you'll love as well, and so much more coming out with every new month that you could consider a lifetime membership to Nebula as well. You just pay once and then you'll get lifetime access to everything that I and hundreds of other creators will ever produce on Nebula for as long as we both last. And you'll never have to worry about a recurring subscription or ads ever again. Normally, a lifetime subscription to Nebula costs $500, but if you use my link, you'll get an incredibly solid 40% off discount and be able to snag one for just $300 instead. That's the best way possible to support what I'm doing here on Real Life Lore. But even if you'd rather not make that large of an upfront commitment, you can still help support me by signing up for a yearly or monthly subscription to Nebula as well, by scanning the QR code or clicking the button here on your screen right now, or by following the link that's down below in the description. I hope that you'll consider signing up, and as always, thank you so much for watching.